Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 17, interview with legendary open class sprint musher George Atla. This is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that makes you want to glautlach and notahodalach in the world of sprint mushing.
You don't actually expect me to get those this week, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that would be the... I have no idea. And we probably beat those words up pretty good, don't you think? Or
I might have. I pray that I didn't offend anybody out there.
Well, I don't know.
You don't know what? What did I say? How do you know I offended somebody if you don't even know what I'm talking about?
I'm pretty confident to know that two folks that have lived in Michigan our whole lives, well, almost our whole lives, have. If we try to do any Native American words like that.
Oh, so you do get some of it. How do you know it's Native American?
Well, I don't even know if it's Native American, or it could be Inuit, or it could be Eskimo. I'm not really sure what the languages are. Maybe that's what we should have, is a language podcast. Okay, maybe not.
Okay.
So what are they?
Well, what do you think?
I don't know. Maybe that's
what,
mush.
What are we talking about today?
Okay. It just hit me. It's got to be G and Ha.
No.
Okay.
But
no.
I want to know what language you think it is. Because
it is not English. That's about all I know.
All right. So who are we interviewing today?
George Atla.
And
legendary.
What is
open
he?
Class sprint musher. He's a sprint musher.
Yeah, I know. But of what is his background? You got the Indian part right. What kind of Indian?
Nope.
Yeah. George Atla is an Athabascan Indian. So that language, hopefully, and again, I already apologized if it's bad, is Athabascan language. And what do you think those words might mean in Athabascan, Tim?
It might mean, well, hello and how are you?
No.
Goodbye?
No.
Yeah.
What was our legendary musher famous for?
Sprint mushing. Open class, sprint mushing.
Okay, so...
Sprint mushing.
No,
that's not it.
They basically, I believe, from my very valuable sources, mean to run fast.
Oh.
Okay, and another one is kind of like lope, which is more of a trot, but also that you need to do, especially in races like the Fur Rendezvous.
How many podcasts do you think we can get the word lope into? That was pretty good. Okay, so it was kind of like what I said, sprint mushing. It's kind of mean to run fast and super fast. Okay,
right. But I'm kind of sad that you didn't remember the Athabascan part. I kind of gave you a little bit of credit for that.
I am terrible with that, so I apologize. I have never really been good at any of that understanding. Somehow, deep in my heart, I also believe that we're all Americans first, and that's why it matters. But anyways, we'll go on from there.
Yeah, let's just go on now.
Okay.
Well, Tim, I want to give a little bit more of a bio on George Atla, just to make sure that those out there that are listening really understand who he is. He is a legendary open-class sprint musher, and he has won more Fur Rendezvous World Championships, 10 to be exact, and more open North American Championships, 8, than any other musher today. He's also won 9 ISDRA, or ISDRA, unlimited class medals as well. So he's got quite a background, but his background is a little bit ago, so I'm not sure that everybody knows exactly who he is, so we wanted to talk a little bit about that before our interview.
Well, I got to be honest, I didn't really understand. I had heard the name a couple of times and never really understood who George really was until not only did we look up his bio and try to find the resources on him and find the movie on him and a bunch of different things. Speaking of which, he's got a movie on him that I don't know if we're going to talk about today, but it's a fantastic movie. Everybody tells me I can't find it. So if anybody has got that movie or knows where I can find it, please let me know. I would love to see that movie.
Well,
maybe we can do a...
And let me interrupt just to let you know. Actually, because of his fame in the past, there was a book written, Everything I Know About Training and Racing Sled Dogs, that George wrote.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's out of print, but it used to be considered the Musher's Bible. So if you could ever grab that book, that would be. And his life story became subject of this film called The Spirit of the Wind, later retitled Atla. And then there's another book about him by Lou Freeman, Spirit of the Wind, the story of George Atla, Alaska's legendary sled dog sprint champ. So that's what's out there, and that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, trying to find some of these things that are out of print, I'm sure over time that people have got them on their shelves and they might be dusty. This is a good time to pull them out and kind of reacquaint ourselves. What a great guy, too. We caught up with George by way of Tim Hunt. And Tim Hunt from drtims.com, and he's a veterinarian up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We were talking to him one day, and he's like, oh, yeah, matter of fact, I know who you got to talk to, George Atla. And we're like, oh, okay. And we didn't really know too much about George. And as we started getting closer to the interview, it started to kind of swell up, and it's like, holy cow.
Well, and let me tell you a little bit why he is legendary. He won his first fur rendezvous in 1958. And so, being that this is 2008, that was 50 years ago. So
since
this is a celebration year for George and even the little village that he currently lives in, Hislia, because it's been 50 years of very successful mushing. His 1958 win launched a career that eventually made this unknown musher the most successful sprint musher in history. Let me go through the other dates for the fur rendezvous too, though. He won again in 1962, 1968, 1972, 1975, 76, 1978, 1979, 1981, and 1982.
Wow.
Therefore, he is a champ. And I put those all together because, you know, it's quick to say he won 10 times, but let's think about winning that year after year after year.
Yeah, and they're spaced out over about 20 years or so. It's amazing. Gene, and by the way, tell us a little bit about the fur rendezvous that happened a couple weeks past, and I know that we were watching, a lot of people were watching, but what's that race all about?
Well, the name fur rendezvous derives from the swap meets at which fur trappers would gather to sell their winter harvest. So in early Anchorage, these usually took place in mid-February, and so the race takes place every year in Anchorage. And the race is 3 days of 25 miles apiece. So there's three heats, 25 miles long.
So 75 miles.
In 3 days.
That's pretty good, wasn't it?
Yeah, that
okay.
Was just fine.
Well, that's cool. And now this is not outside the city. This is actually in the city limits, right?
Yeah, it is in the city limits, though it does reach trails. So it's not just like running through streets the whole time. They run through the streets and then go through trails.
They don't have to, like, fight crosswalks and people crossing and that kind of stuff, do they? That'd be kind of, like, New York City, good snowstorm. Wouldn't that be tough? Okay, probably not that crazy.
Some of these dogs are running, like, 20, 30 miles an hour. I don't think I'd get in their way.
That's a good point. So he's won in multiple different races, multiple different times. He's had just a fantastic career of it. Even in the interview, as we talked to him, it was just so wonderful to hear how he got into it and what made him do what he did. You know, it wasn't just a, hey, I think I'll go out for this money. I think I'll just go out for this. It was all about the competition, and it was about winning, and it was about having a good time while he did it.
Another race that George did extremely well in, and I believe still holds the most wins for, is the Open North American Championship.
What's that about?
Well, after World War II in 1946, they held this race, but then it was called just the North American Championship. And originally, it was a four-day event, 18 miles, 18 miles, 18 miles, then 20 miles, which followed the Chena and the Tanana rivers. And then it moved to a place called Creamer's Field in 1953, which then changed to a 20-mile, 20-mile, and 30-mile heat, so it went to a three-day heat. And George also has the most wins for this race at 8 wins.
Fantastic. It's interesting because we live so far away, and a lot of our listeners live overseas or on the New England area of the United States. We don't hear about a lot of these other races, so it's great to know. Hey, Gina, as we went through the interview, one of the things I noticed is we talked a lot about George as a young man and as an adult, but we didn't really know too much about his history as a young man. Do we have a lot of information on that?
You know, I just picked up a little bit, and I thought I'd just read this to our audience, just so you know, because we did not go here in the interview. His early life consisted of a series of setbacks. He had developed tuberculosis, and his right kneecap actually ceased to function, rendering him pretty much unable to bend that knee. So he spent a lot of time in hospitals, and he never actually got past second grade. So when he returned to the village of Hislia, which is where he resides today, he was pretty much unfit for normal native village jobs. So he turned to dog mushing. His success in refusing to give in to his handicap made him an inspiration, really, to all who knew him. So, and that also, Tim, is why they did a movie on him that you asked about earlier, The Spirit of the Wind.
That is incredible. You know, that's probably one of the best part about why I like to do these interviews, is because you don't just hear about these people that are racing and winning and just racing, but it's hearing how they've overcome some of the major obstacles in their life. And talk about this is just amazing. So I think you're going to listen to this and really hear somebody that is not going to quit. And hopefully we can all take away from this that it's not about quitting. It's about conquering whatever's in your way and overcoming those things that might try to stop you in your life. So, hey, let's go to the interview, and don't forget, right after this interview, we've got an interview with Dr. Tim, and here we go. Now, this has been your 50th year that you've been into dog racing. How in the world did you ever get into dog racing?
It was a way of life back then, you know. I mean, that's what my dad was, a trapper, and that was the only transportation there was in the wintertime.
And did you do it for not only to get around, but was it just a way of life? Was it just a natural way of life for everybody at the time?
Yeah, at the time back here, when I was a kid, back in the late 40s and early 50s, it was just the way, they were a necessity, you know.
And so what made the difference for you, I guess from the point of using the dogs to get around to actually using them to race and for the sport?
Well, racing in Alaska used to be the biggest thing that happened in the state of Alaska in the wintertime, you know, for the outlying villages. In fact, everything stopped for 3 days to be able to listen to the race on the radio, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
So it was a big thing.
So what was the first race that you got into? Was it when you were young? Obviously, you were about 25 or so.
When I ran the Rendezvous, I was 24 years old, and that was actually, to be honest with you, I have never won a race before I won the Rendezvous. We didn't do that much racing here in the village, you know. We might race in the spring, say in April, and then we might race in New Year's, and that was it, you know.
Right.
Then we were very aware, we became aware that we had good dogs. We didn't even know the quality of the dogs we had back then until the guy that won the Rendezvous and a North American came to race against us up in a village called Hughes. And he came in fourth, three of the guys beat him, you know.
Oh, wow.
So we became aware that we got good dogs.
So what'd you do?
Well, the next year, the guys start putting teams together, you know, and went in. Like, Jimmy Huntington was the first one, and he won the Rendezvous and the North American. And Bobby Vent was from here, too. He went in with Jimmy, and he took second in both races.
What was it about your dogs that were so special?
Well, times were tough back then, you know, and only the fittest and the toughest survived, you know. You couldn't afford to keep any dogs that you weren't happy with, you know, because of shortage of feed. So we all had very few dogs, but the ones we had were top quality dogs, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
And once you decided to race, how many dogs would you keep?
Did you have a big kennel or a small kennel?
No, I didn't. Actually, I only had 6 dogs of my own at the time, but only 2 of them made it. Mm. And the rest came from, the people in the village here.
So when you ran, you kind of ran as a village more than just an individual team almost.
Yeah, I was the one in that given year in 1958 that was actually representing the village of Hooslia.
Did you have your own sled and your own gear?
I had my own sled and my own gear, you know, but I sure didn't have my own dogs.
That's neat. So then what happened after a few years?
You know, that given year, 1958, there was so many good dogs in this village that if you hurt one, you could go to another neighbor and get another dog that would go into team that was every bit as good as the one you just crippled, you know.
Right.
And then in later years, I didn't go back again until 1962, you know. I stayed home for the simple reason that I didn't think I had a good enough dog team, you know. Until 1962, it looked like I had a good dog team, you know. So I went back and I won the rendezvous again.
That's wonderful. Then how many years did you win it right after that? Was it consecutive?
No, I never won the rendezvous again until 1968. And I actually didn't win the North American until, I believe it was 1969. That was my first year of winning North American.
George, for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about the Fur Rendezvous race, like the distance and the difficulty of it?
Yeah, it's a 25-mile race, and I would say it's closer to being called a mid-distance than a sprint race, you know. And it's so tough, like going, you take off in the main part of town, which is 4th Avenue, and you're pretty much running in a city the whole time for 25 miles, you know. So it's not an easy race, you know. You have to be a good dog man, you know, especially coming from the village. These villages, you know, these dogs had never seen that many people before, you know, so it was all new to them, you know. So, I mean, it's a tough race. I always call it a thinking man's race, you know.
Why is that?
Because most of these other races, like you take the North American, you know, all you do is hook up your dogs and go as fast as you can go. You know, you don't have to think about it. You know, you have to have fast dogs. The man with the fastest dogs usually wins that race, you know. The rendezvous is a completely different race because dogs can't run that fast and that heat for that far, you know. So, you know, you have to be able to judge your animal really well.
Oh, absolutely. That's interesting.
And is it pretty easy to make it around the race as far as where to go and how to do that? Does that take part in the race at all?
Yeah, it's easy to get around. But back when I started, these dogs that we brought in from the village here was like driving a car. You could tell the dogs where to go, and they always take you where you tell them to take you. You know? You couldn't get a leader like that today, you know, but back in those days, we used these dogs for trapping, so in reality, they were taught to listen to you, you know.
Why do you think it's so different today? Is it just the amount of time we spend with the dogs, you think?
That plus the time you put into your leader, you know, to train them. I don't think those leaders we had back then, I don't think there's a dog alive today that, you know, that could take commands like those dogs can.
And what was the main breed? Were they all Siberian Huskies, or what were they back then?
They were a mixed breed, you know. They were Mongol. There was, you know, nothing special about them. But they were the toughest animals on earth, I think. I mean, you know, their dogs are not as tough as those dogs were back then, you know, because the people are the same way. There's no way that today's people are as tough as the people back then, and their dogs were tough, you know.
Oh, absolutely. So then you raced for many years. Tell us about the 70s and the 80s. What did you do during those years as far as racing?
70 to 1980 were my best years, you know, in that 10-year span, late 60s and early 80s were my best years. I was, you know, I was had good dogs for, like, say, 15 years, you know.
What did you like about racing so much? Did you like the competitiveness of it, or did you like the stories and the camaraderie of the other mushers?
I like the competition. I love competition, you know. The tougher it is, the more I love it, you know. If it isn't tough enough to make it interesting, I was always looking forward to it, you know, a real tough competitor.
Was it the race or was it the people that you liked being tough against?
Well, it's usually the musher that's handling the dogs, you know. So, you know, the more competition they can give you, you know, the more I used to love it, you know, because it was always a challenge, you know. I mean, you can win, but if you get beat, it's hard to overcome a loss, you know, or say in a 3-day race, you know, you're through a third of the race, you know, and you have one third to go. It's a real thrill if you're behind to try to overcome that.
At what time did you decide that sprint races were really your thing and that the more long-distance races were not your thing?
I believe I came to realize that in 1973 when the Iditarod started. I tried it and I realized how miserable you could actually get on the trail.
What? How did you get miserable?
How miserable did you get, George?
Well, you know, I was about as miserable as you can imagine. And I really didn't realize it until probably the third day of the Iditarod. You know, you start saying, no sleep yet? When am I going to go to bed? You know, when can I go to bed? And back then, there was no trail to speak of. The army was ahead of us, you know, but they were so far ahead of us that there was no sign of their trail, you know. We had to break our own trail most of the time. I mean, long-distance racing has never been my thing since then. I tried the Iditarod again after that. I know I wasn't all there when I tried it the first time, and the second time I tried it, I actually realized I didn't have all my marbles together, you know? I mean, you're asking for a bruise and getting the Iditarod, you know?
Right. Oh, my goodness.
So what's the longest race you have done?
The Iditarod is the longest race. I've done a couple 300 miles, you know, over there in Cusco 300. I come in second two times, you know, that I tried it, you know. But other than that, the Iditarod has been the longest race that I've ever ran.
So what's your favorite race?
My favorite race is probably, without a doubt, the Fur Rendezvous in Anchorage.
What do you like about that race? Because it's such a mind race and because you can, I guess, see the days go by with, you know, where you're standing and so forth?
Yeah, the thing I like about it is, you know, the dogs just have so much strength. You know, it's like having a gallon of gas in your car, you know, and you have to make it 20 miles with it. And you have to figure out how you're going to burn that fuel, you know, because if you burn it too fast, you're going to run out of gas, you know. And the same way with a dog team, you know, if you don't gauge your speed right according to the strength of the dog, you're not gonna win.
So do you find yourself having to hold them back, basically, for a good portion of the race?
Not necessarily to hold them back, but tell them when to run hard, you know, and that kind of stuff. Of course, it's a different story today. They have a different type of dog today, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just got done listening to the North American this past weekend, you know, and it sounds to me like today's dogs are controlling the mushers. The mushers back there going for a ride.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, you either got good dogs or you don't. That's what today's dogs are like.
So back when your kennel was booming and you're winning a lot of races, I think you said in the 70s, that 15-year stretch, did you really get into a breeding program? Did you have a large kennel or did you still kind of count on the village?
No, you know, the Snowgoes kind of took over the kennels, the village dog teams, you know, in the early 60s it started. You didn't have a supply anymore, you know, so I moved to Fairbanks in 1972 and started my own breeding program, you know. I actually moved to Fairbanks with a whole bunch of dogs that I had here, you know, from the village, and started my own breeding program.
So how big was your kennel there for a while? Was it 20 or 30 or bigger?
No, it was much bigger than that. It was closer to 100 dogs.
Wow.
Yeah, I settled in Fairbanks. Another reason I moved there was the freight is so high, you know, to the village here that you couldn't hardly afford to feed a bunch of dogs here.
So just getting the dog food in and the supplies, huh?
Yeah, actually, today's freight rate, you buy a bag of dog food in Fairbanks, and by the time you get it to Hooslea, it's more than double.
Wow, even today?
Yeah, if you paid $40 for a 40-pound bag of dog food, it'll probably cost you closer to another $50 by the time you get it here.
I guess I'll never complain about my dog food prices if you guys have to deal with that. That's crazy.
Right. A person can't keep a big kennel out here. You know, for me, it's just a lifestyle. I love living out here and being able to go out in the country and all that good stuff, you know.
Well, tell us a little bit about your day. What are you doing now? I know you're trapping and you're doing some different things, but tell everybody what you're up to.
Well, I work on sleds, you know, and I work on these dogs. I figured some of the guys are coming out to the villages here, you know, so, you know, it'll be fun putting a team up against them.
So you're just hanging out locally, basically? Are you going to travel at all to see any more races? Or this is 50 years. Are you going to race again this year somewhere?
I may, right here locally, you know, just for the fun of it, because of so many guys coming, you know, like Buddy said he's coming. I think Ross Saunderson might be coming, you know, and then there's Curtis Earhart, you know, and some of the guys that actually ran North American will be here for the races, you know. So if I'm having a good weekend and I'm feeling good, I was thinking maybe I'll race against them, you know.
Let's go back for a second about breeding and when you were breeding dogs. And I'm sure many, many people can say that they have Atla dog in their line because of how many dogs you've had. But what did you look for when you were breeding back then for the best sprint dog?
Mainly a good mind and a good build. If you don't have the mind and the build, there's no way that you could make a square box run fast. The box has to have a little length to it, you know. So, and you know about breeding, if the stars are not lined up right and the moon is not shining right, you're not going to get any good dog.
Now, how do you know when the moon and the stars are lined up right?
You don't.
I knew you were going to say that. Darn.
Yeah. Everybody has a magic formula, you know. But I've never found the answer, you know. Yes, I raised a lot of good dogs, you know, but bred a lot of great dogs. But that doesn't mean you're going to get a good dog, you know.
Sure. Can you give us a story or tell us about a dog that had a good mind?
Well, I got a dog, a half Siberian from a friend of mine here in Hooslea one time. And that was back in the 70s when I had a super dog team, you know, and he said, I got this dog that looked really good, you know, which was probably an accidental breeding, you know. And here I had my breeding program, you know, all down to perfection, you know, and he sends this dog up, which was probably an accidental breeding here in the village, and it actually ran in front of my team, you know, it ran in front of a winning team, so...
Mm-hmm. Just all by accident.
A guy that, you know, been around as long as I have and bred dogs for years and never came up with no magic formula. Nobody can tell me this is the way to do it, you know.
I was going to say, is it better to breed many dogs and then just find the ones that are the best? Or do you get very, very selective in your breeding?
Well, for one thing, yeah, what I select for, you know, like is I say the mind and the right build, you know, and that kind of stuff. But today is a different world. It's a different dog that's racing out there. He's not the same animal that I used to race. You know, these dogs are self-driven. All you have to do is get the animals, these animals that these guys are running, get them really tough and teach them how to run fast. And there's no reason why you can't be as good or almost as good as most people, because today's dogs are self-driven, you know. They're running because they want to, you know.
Absolutely.
Back in the days when I was racing with my Huskies, there was days that they really didn't want to run, you know, but I had so much control over them that I told them, maybe you don't want to run today. Well, I don't want to run either, you know, but there's a race on. So we run. But today's dogs are just, they're a different animal. You don't have to be a good dog man, I don't think, to run these bird dogs, you know, because you have to have the strength to hang on, you know, because that's all they want to do.
Have you made the switch over? Have you been breeding them into your line at all, or are you still sticking with the Huskies?
No, I switched over, you know. I tell you, I mean, they're harder to hang on to for an old man, you know.
I think for anybody.
it's sure fun to run them, you know, because that's all they want to do. Of course, the Huskies wanted to run too, you know, but they dependent on you because of the training, you know, that you put into them, and they more or less waited for your command all the time.
Spending as much time with the Huskies and the newer dogs out in the field, I guess you've probably had lots of experiences of every type. Is there any, you know, memorable stories that you could share with the folks? Have you ever got caught in the blizzards or had any, you know, wildlife situations or anything to share with anybody?
You mean as far as the dogs go? No, I've never, ever had a problem with a moose, you know, or any of that good stuff, you know. You know, I just been fortunate enough. I never have ran into any sort of an animal with my dog team.
That's wonderful. Now, are you using the newer dogs to run trap lines and that type of thing also for a working dog, or are they mainly just for racing?
You know, I don't think the way these dogs act, I got them to play with, you know, and they wouldn't fit on a trap line anyway, you know, because they wouldn't wait, you know, they won't run so hard, you know, say if you had a trap set that they're not going to stand there and wait, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Husky was a different type animal, you know. He'd stop at your trap and he'd rest while you're checking your traps, you know. But I could just imagine even trying to stop with these dogs out there, you know, on a training trail, almost impossible, you know, because they want to run so bad.
George, can you just give us a little bit about how you did train your dogs to stop and to listen to you, and how do you begin that process, and when do you begin that process?
You mean back when I was trapping or when I was racing dogs?
I guess both, if you use the same dog. And, you know, it's okay, we're not talking about the dogs for today. Some of us don't have the pointer crosses quite yet.
Yeah, we're still in the Huskies.
We still have some of those Huskies and the Alaskans here in Michigan. So can you just tell us a little bit about some of your training techniques? I know they'd be invaluable.
Yeah, I don't know if I can, but, you know, back when we had the Huskies, you know, we actually used to make a living with these dogs. You know, when I first came out of the woods, we made a living with these dogs. So sometimes they may be out on trap line for 30 days in a row, you know. So naturally, when you said, whoa, you know, they actually whoa, you know, they want to stop, you know, because, you know, of the work we were getting out of them. Type of dogs that are being run today, they don't know the meaning of the word, you know. For all they know, you might be telling them to hurry just for the simple reason that they heard you open your mouth, you know.
That's about it, yeah.
Yeah, these are not thinking dogs people are racing today, you know. They actually don't think like the Husky did years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, years ago, you could look at a dog and you could read him, you know, you could read his body language. But you'd have a hard time reading a bird dog today, his body language, because he's always acting the same, you know. Years ago, I used to be able to go out in the morning and start working on my dogs, and I'll find out actually what kind of move I'm in myself, you know, just by watching my dog.
Interesting.
So back then when you were racing, how did you G-Haw train?
Back when I started, you didn't have to, because most of these leaders came off the trap line, you know. So coming off the trap line, they're usually, you know, going where there's no trail, you know, and you try to go the easiest way, you know. And the leader would, you know, before too long catch on to that you're actually picking the easiest way. And even if you were going through the woods where there's no trail, the leader actually learns on his own that he can't go through a spot that was only a foot wide and his sled is 20 inches wide, you know. He caught on to that, too, you know, that he can't, you know, do things like that. You know, back then it was a different world. You know, it wasn't only the men that were thinking. You know, the dog was actually thinking on its own, too, you know. It was a different animal. You know what I always say? You know, there's a lot of people that got really good dogs but couldn't really get the best out of them for the simple reason that the person is too well educated and he can't think like a dog, you know? Us people that came out from the woods here, we pretty much think of basic things. We're not that well educated, you know, so we use a lot of body language, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Very interesting. And, you know, going back, I guess, to in time, you know, we had heard that you had worked with a lot of the Alaskan natives and helped a lot of the young folks up there and so forth to help them get out of trouble and that kind of stuff. Tell us a little bit about that, because I know a lot of the mushers have big hearts and really do care about the places they live.
Well, you know, a lot of times when you get problem kid from someone, those are the kids I had, you know, or the kids that came to me were problem kids. And, you know, I've had as many as 12 kids in my house at one time. And down through the years, I've never had a problem with any of the kids. I couldn't tell you how I did it. You know, it wasn't because I was mean, but I always kept them busy, you know. I always had a lot of work for them to do, you know. There was no sitting around playing video games or any of that good stuff, you know. So they always had work to do.
Why did you do it to start with, I guess?
Well, I don't know why I did it, you know, but mostly it was family members, you know, like my brother's kids, my sister's kids, you know, and kids that they were having problems with. And then I got, you know, some kids maybe that one of my family members tried to straighten out and couldn't, you know, and they would send me the kid, you know. And there was no such thing as any government agency involved, you know. It was just a volunteer thing, you know.
And what kind of things did you have them do? Was it mainly working with the dogs or working in the yard or doing all kinds of things?
Yeah. It was mainly working with the dogs, you know. I never forgot one year when I used to race in the Midwest back in the 70s, when I actually left my older son. He was probably 16, still going to high school, you know. I think it was his last year. I left him with 5 other boys, and I had about 40 pups and, you know, left a lot of gas in a bulk tank I had there. And he had a truck. He had grocery money that I left him. And I actually left those kids for a month while I was traveling and racing. And when I came home, the house was still there, you know.
Did they have any good stories for you?
Yeah, I can't even imagine that today, you know. How did I get away with that?
Well, because you cared, and your 16-year-old was probably more responsible than a lot of the 30-year-olds today.
But I always think back on it, you know. And I thought, God, did I get away with murder, you know?
And the fact that you thought to leave him, to even think about it.
Yeah. Oh, boy, huh?
That kind of ranks up with doing the Iditarod the second time.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't do that twice, huh? So as far as these the children as they grew up, do you keep in touch with any of them at all?
Oh, yeah, they're all doing well. You know, today they're all doing well. They're all working people, you know. Most of them are up on the oil fields and that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's great.
You know, so I'm really happy about that, you know.
So you got a pretty big family out there watching over you.
Oh, boy, you're not kidding, you know. That's how I'm comfortably getting to be an old man, you know. Because of all these kids, like, I may get probably 6 phone calls every day, you know, wanting to know how I'm doing, you know, and that kind of good stuff, you know.
Oh, that's great.
And grandkids all over the place, you know. If there isn't enough of them around, I adopt more, you know.
That's great.
So I'm having a good time.
With all the years of the dogs, what do you love the most about working with the dogs?
You know, to work with animals in my lifetime have been one of the most enjoyable things I have ever done, you know. A dog actually could get to know you better than your fellow human being, you know, and I enjoy that about them. You know, they could actually tell you by looking at you how you're feeling, you know, and what kind of a day you're having. You know, it's such a pleasure because any time you walk out into the yard, you know, they're so happy to see you. I've never seen a dog that didn't respond to me, you know, but I couldn't say the same thing about my fellow human being.
I agree.
So how can you go wrong with a dog team, you know?
Absolutely. What are some other mistakes that you see mushers make today who could use some wisdom from the years past?
You know, the way it looked to me, I mean, just watching these dogs and then watching the times that these people are making, you know. In today's races, there are hardly any mistakes made. You know, it's leading up to the race that the mistakes are made. And the race itself, by watching the times from point to point, you could actually see that the dogs are actually taking the driver for a ride. There's no doubt in my mind about that, for the simple reason that if the times were not consistent, they were fast to some point and some areas slow, then you could say this guy is trying to move. You know, this guy is actually trying to move. But if you see consistent speed for all 3 days, the dogs are actually doing the racing, you know. I mean, I'm sure could stick an old man like me behind one of those dog teams that are winning, and if I was able to hang on, I'm sure I could win with them because, you know, you just need the physical strength to be able to hang on to them because they're so crazy, you know?
Absolutely.
So where's it all going? I mean, are we just going to keep going faster and faster? Do you think that sport will lose some of its trueness, or what do you think?
Well, I don't think they're going to get much faster until these mushers that are doing it professionally can get more speed out of these dogs. What the dogs have, you know, if you turn a dog loose, one of these race dogs, and you took off with your snow machine, the dog can actually go up to 35 miles an hour, you know, and some of them pretty comfortably. So you're actually going maybe 20, 21 miles an hour is your top speed in any given race, you know. So imagine you probably got 14 miles an hour you're not using. I mean, even the best dog man today has got 14 miles an hour that he's not utilizing, you know.
So, George, do you think technology will play into that as far as ways to make the sleds better or to, you know, to capture that 14 miles an hour or just the way that you incentivize or give, you know, motivation to the dogs?
I mean, you know, if a dog can run that fast, if you were a professional dog man, which, you know, there's a very few of those, you know, that's what you did for a living, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to get that, you know. It's not technology. The sleds, like I designed a sled myself the last 7 years that I could ride, you know. I could run these dogs, you know. Hell, I'm 74 years old, and I could actually hook up a team that, you know, that has full strength and be able to ride it. You know, the only part that hurt is when they're, you know, if you hit a bump or something when you come down, you know. But so I don't think the sled will get any better, you know, without a motor to help it.
Right.
But the dog people could actually get more out of these dogs that were running.
Interesting.
You know, anyone should be able to figure that out because you turn your dog loose, you know he's running 30 miles an hour or faster if he's a really good athlete.
What slows him down on the team? Is it the fact that there's slower dogs that might be slowing them down?
No, mainly it's that little drag that's restricting them, you know, and nobody has put enough time into these dogs, you know, to be able to permit them to run faster because we know they're able to. You know, it's something that would take a lot of time. You have to be a pro. I mean, that's all you're going to do for a living is run these dogs. you know, you have to be young and have a lot of time and someone feeding your dogs, I suppose, you know?
Absolutely.
But doesn't that make sense to you? I mean,
it does.
You got a dog that could run 35, top out at 35, and you're only getting 21 miles an hour out of him, you know, is his top speed. That's all you're getting in the harness, you know?
Well, and I wonder if it's the weight or if it's, you know, the motivation or the, well, who knows what, but you're right. We should be able to tap into that. With the new dogs that you're running now, do you think about that more than maybe you did in the past because you can see the differences in the speed and the pull and that kind of thing?
Yeah, but I come from the old school, you know, and I selecting these dogs maybe for the wrong reason, you know. I've always select dogs with a certain gait, and maybe that's a handicap. You know, I really don't know because I'm not racing these dogs most of the time. You know, I'm just mainly having a good time, you know.
What's that gait look like to you? Is it a trotting gait or is it more of a loping?
It's a loping gait that is just as smooth as you can imagine, you know. Actually, that back line on that dog never slacks up. Whether he's coming down or coming off the ground, the same amount of pull is always on that line. That's the gait that I love, you know?
Absolutely. Now, do you remember a lot of your dogs in the past? All your different leads and a lot of the different names that you've had?
Oh, yes. I remember all my leaders, I think. Maybe a dog would a different gait, you could actually get more speed out of. I don't know, you know. But I'm so used to selecting gait within my pups that that's what I love to watch, you know.
Absolutely. Now, are you still selling dogs today?
Oh, now and then. I don't have that many, you know, but yeah, I sell a few.
Now, George, you obviously have a stellar past, and people have even quoted you as a legend. Do you have any regrets at all about your past mushing years?
No, I've thought about that many times, you know. Do I have any regrets, you know? No, I don't. As far as my dogs are concerned, I think today they make me as happy as they did 50 years ago, you know.
Oh, that's great.
You know, so I've had a great time with my dog team over the years. Yeah, it's been a pleasure working with animals all my life. I had a great time.
Now, you moved back to the village that you grew up in. What took you back there?
Well, I like being able to walk out the door and get on my machine in the wintertime and go out in the country, you know, or get in my boat in the summertime and, you know, just travel where I feel like traveling, you know. And I love the wilds, you know. I love being out in the country. What I imagine is the life I'm living now, people would pay to be able to do this, you know. And I got it all in the palm of my hand, actually, almost for nothing, you know.
That's wonderful.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, I just didn't know if after listening to this interview, you might have a lot of people call you up and say, can they come move in and live with you? Do you need any dog handlers? I guess now's the time to ask, huh?
And you mentioned Dr. Tim earlier, you know?
Yeah.
He gave me some dog food last fall, you know, from his dog food company, that Momentum.
Yes, absolutely.
And I've been really happy, you know, I've been really happy with that feed.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hard to get good quality food, and that's the best I've seen so far.
Oh, that's great. So have you seen a big change in that over time as well, about what people feed their dogs and how that's all working to help build a better racer?
Oh, yeah, all that is making the times faster today, you know, the quality of the dog food. And the quality of the trails. You know, you could imagine when I started back in 1958, even in Anchorage, the dog racing trail I raced back then was not put in by a machine. It was actually put in by a dog team. So you always hear people say the dogs are getting faster today and all that good stuff. Well, I believe in 1958 that I had dogs that could run with anything today. The only thing that's improved over the years is that, you know, we have our groomed trails, we have top quality dog food, we have our veterinarians. We didn't have any of that. You know, when I started, fat back in my early years, the only veterinarian I knew and the guy that used to help me was a guy named Doc Lombard from back east. And he was my competitor, you know, but he was the only vet around.
Did you ever question his advice because he was a competitor?
No. That's a good question, you know, but I never, ever doubted that he was helping me, you know. But the only thing I didn't trust was I didn't trust what he told me, you know, like if he advised me on doing something, that I didn't trust. But as far as treating my dog for not feeling well, I know he was doing the right thing, you know, because of the type of person he was.
Yeah, you could trust him for the dogs, but he wasn't going to help you win the race, huh?
Right, right. Yep, he was a guy that actually you could beat on the head with a club and he'll come up smiling at you, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that makes quite a difference.
Oh, boy, I guess so, you know. I mean, not only in the performance of the dog, but you could also feel it in your hip pocket, you know.
Did you get to know the other mushers during the races? Were they friends, even though they were adversaries? Did you really get to know them a lot?
Oh, yeah. Back then, back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we were all friends. We used to actually, you know, we'll all be invited to the same house, you know, and we always had a good time, you know. Yeah, it's a different world today, you know.
Do you keep in touch with any of those mushers still?
Most of them have gone to the Happy Hunting Ground, and they're probably running my famous leaders up there, you know, getting ready for me.
All right. Do you have any really good, memorable races, George?
Yeah, I don't. Someone asked me that the other day, you know, and I don't remember the exact year, but it was in the middle 70s. I ran a race in Anchorage, and I had ran my dogs. They were a fantastic dog team. Probably one of the... I had a truckload of dogs that were nothing but good dogs, and there was probably 40 dogs in there. And 2 weeks before the rendezvous, I broke down in Watson Lake, and I had a... It took me 2 weeks to work my way back to Alaska. And I got to the rendezvous the night before the race. I got into Anchorage. And when I pulled the dogs out the next morning, they didn't look like they wanted to run. You know, they looked tired, you know, from riding so much. So I had so many good dogs. I selected the dogs that were not really crazy to go. I figured, well, they're going to have to go out easy in order to make it. They haven't ran for so long, you know. And that day, I came in fifth, but the second day, they gave me a ride of my life. I started fifth, and I actually crossed the finish line first.
Wow.
I mean, you know, it was an unbelievable ride, you know. I mean, I thought, holy cow, you know, this. And they ran their own race, you know. I mean, the thing was that they, the 2 liters held the dogs back probably for the first 15 miles. But the last 10 miles, they made those dogs run probably as hard as they've ever ran.
That's great.
The leaders have been on that trail before, you know, so they know how much strength it was going to take, you know. But it was the most fantastic ride I've ever had in my life.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, do you remember the names of those leaders?
Frot and Freckle.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, did any of your children get into racing?
They did when they were growing up. They all raced, you know, and they all won their junior races, you know. But I never told my kids, here, this is the best I got. You take them and run the junior races with them. I've always told my kids that if they want to race, there was a lot of pups in the yard that they train their own team, you know. And, you know, they wind up winning their junior races, training their own team, but I've never trained dogs for the juniors. But none of my kids are in it today except one, you know, but then he works up on the oil field, you know, one of those jobs that you're out in the oil field for 2 weeks and you're home for 2 weeks, you know, so you actually don't put in enough time with the dogs, you know.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, today's world is a little tougher, you know.
I mean, George, we always like to ask our interviewees, is there any other passions that you have outside of the world of dogs and mushing and so forth?
Oh, I love, like, I'm snaring beaver right now, and I love doing that. I love to hunt and fish, you know, and when I was younger, I used to love to travel, you know, I used to do a lot of traveling, but I got that out of my system, and now I'm having a good time camping and hunting, you know, and fishing and all that good stuff. I mean, it's a quality of life in my mind that I don't see how a person would want more, you know. I mean, what else is there in this world?
Now, do you enjoy all that fun beaver snaring stuff all on your own, or do you like to be with companions? Is it the solitude?
Yeah, I love being by myself, you know, but a lot of times I take a few kids out with me, you know, out snaring beaver, you know, and just someone might walk up to you and say, my kid doesn't like to go out. You know, he spends his whole day, you know, playing video games and that kind of stuff. I love going out with those kids because they seem to enjoy what I'm doing, you know. So, I mean, I get such a thrill out of a child's happiness, you know?
Absolutely.
It's not something you could buy, you know? I mean, it's a pleasure, you know?
Oh, absolutely. So what do you got planned for the next 25 or 30 years?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm going to, in the future, starting this year, I'm going to make a comeback.
Yeah? At what?
At dog racing.
All right.
Yeah, I just got done telling you for an hour how easy it looks, you know.
Right.
People are going to call you on the carpet for this one, right? These dogs just pull you. You know, all you have to do is hold on, right?
To see those 35-mile-an-hour times.
Yeah, we want to get that 30 miles an hour.
Yeah, you know, the only problem I actually have is I hit some of these bumps, you know, and it doesn't feel that good anymore, you know. Body really can't take a beating like it used to, you know.
So if we design you a sled with shock absorbers, then we're okay then, right? You'll take it then?
Yeah, I've been trying that, you know. I made the sled that you could actually steer, you know, and you know, the skis are pretty much like a ski where you don't hit solid, you know, where it has a little spring. But even that quite do it, you know.
No, I can imagine.
There's nothing wrong with dreaming, you know.
Well, I hear you, for sure. This has been wonderful. Is there anything you'd like to add or tell anybody?
No, just that I'd like to thank Dr. Tim for letting me use his dog food, you know. That was one of the biggest breaks I've got.
Absolutely.
At my old age, who the heck would want to feed my dog beside Dr. Tim, huh?
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, he's a good man.
Well, thank you so much for spending so much time with us, and please have a wonderful evening.
Okay, thank you. I had fun. I hope you enjoyed it.
We absolutely did, George. Thank you so much. You made our day.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
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 Oh, wasn't that fantastic, dear?
Yeah, really interesting.
What part did you like the most about the interview?
Well, as a mom, you know, Tim, I'm always about children. So it was just really cool how he, even before, he was always kind of reaching out to help kids. And even in his age now, he really still likes to take the kids trapping. And he likes to offer different things to children to open their eyes to see nature.
Yeah, and to think about that whole idea of, you know, what is it, the ripple effect of how many lives he's touched by helping, you know, not just a handful, but quite a few handfuls of children, and how they've gone out probably to help others and others and others that may have not really had a chance to carry on. I think it's just, it's amazing to see some people and how they treat life more than just about themselves. It goes beyond what they're capable of or what we're capable of thinking sometimes.
All right, and you know what, Tim? We have mail. So
yeah, we do. We've got a couple of pieces of mail. We want to say thank you so much for everybody that writes into us. First, I want to say thank you to Peter and Krista Frankie. Thank you so much. They've got a great website. If you're bored, you want to go out to www.snowrunner.blogspot.com. I just wanted to say thanks, and they wrote us to say thank you. So they're listening. And also, we want to say thank you to Jeffrey Sipper. And this was a really neat email. Jeffrey sent us a nice big email. He's a fifth grade instructor, but he sent us or got us hooked onto this link for polarhusky.com. And it's just a really neat program. You got to go out to it. It's all about an exploration. It's all about these multi-year trips and expeditions that they've planned for research. So it's just a really neat website. So go out to polarhusky.com also. So thank you so much. And don't forget, anybody can email us. We love getting email. We get a lot of questions. We get some funny stories. Anything that you want to send to us at tim@sleddogpodcast.com or gina@sleddogpodcast.com. And you know, there's a couple things that we're going to be doing in the future. We're going to be getting more user content, more of your content up on the website. But I do have a question for everybody. Is I would love to see what people use for fall training. We're getting into spring now, and I know people are maybe dusting off carts or doing different things, but I would love to see pictures of carts and pictures of fall training bikes and scooters and different things that people use. So if you've got any pictures, go ahead and send them to us at tim@sleddogpodcast.com, or you can get to our information off the website at www.sleddogpodcast.com. So now let's go to the interview with Dr. Tim. Here we go. Well, thank you, Dr. Tim. Let's talk about summer care.
Sure. As we go from winter to spring and spring to summer with our sled dogs, we have to start to consider different things with how we're going to manage our kennel. And a few of the things that will change as we go along will be just, number one, how we water our dogs. Our kennel is set up with large 5-gallon buckets that we attach to the posts of the dog houses. They have free access to water as long as it's warm enough so it doesn't freeze. Some people don't like to do that. They like to have it regulated. It's always worked very well for us to have buckets out there. They chew on them a little bit, but it's never been detrimental. So free access water has been one thing I tend to advocate. If you're not doing free access water, we still have to water our dogs at least twice a day. And when we get into the hotter weather, sometimes even 3 times a day. So we've got to be aware that water is our number one nutrient that's needed out there with our sled dogs, and how we're going to manage that is key. There's no way they can eat snow to try to get water or on dirt. So make sure we get water into the dogs because that's our most important nutrient. Number two is shade. I think shade is definitely undervalued in that. I wouldn't want to be in a desert all day long sitting out in the blazing heat. So if we have a kennel that's set out in the trees in the forest, that's terrific, so they can get lots of shade that way. It might incur a little bit of drying issues with your soil, but I think it's definitely offset by them being able to get out of the sunlight. If you ever felt a dog that's laying in the sun for a long period of time, especially the black ones, their surface temperature is quite a bit higher. And dogs can heat stroke just sitting in their dog chain, running around in a circle for that matter. So we need some level of shade for our animals. Now, how we're going to do that, I've seen a lot of different setups. One, we're not afforded the chance to put our kennel into the woods. And I've seen different deals with plywood coverings on top of the dog houses, and there's a lot of different things out there, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I've also seen it where the houses are raised above the ground, so the house itself casts a shadow so the dogs can find their own happy spot when it's sunny out. If they choose not to find the shade, that's their choice, but at least they're afforded an opportunity to do that. So finding some way to provide shade for your dogs, I think, is really important for them. Again, equate yourself sitting out in the sunlight, and being at the beach is great, but not for the whole day. So give them some level of shade for that matter. Feeding, often our feeding schedules are going to be changed somewhat in the summertime, not less quality of food, but often less of a quantity of food because they don't have to keep their furnaces going to keep themselves as warm. So we might be reducing our food amounts and thus reducing how much stool that we have to clean up. But it doesn't cause us to forego the reason that we have to clean the poop up, which is just hygiene. So we still have to keep the dog's circles cleaned up, or the kennel or runs for that matter, because flies are going to be attracted to that, and that's just going to compound issues too. So trying to keep the hygiene up of the dog yard is a little simpler, I think, in the summertime, but again, because of the parasite issues, flies and internal worms and stuff, let's just try to keep the poop picked up that way. Can you guys think of anything else with summertime?
Dr. Tim, can you tell us what are some symptoms of heat stroke? How would we even know if our dog got too hot?
Sure. Heat stroke is something you're going to see with a dog in, you know, 0 degree weather or 80 degree weather for that matter, often with some level of exertion. And the first thing I'll tell people is you'll have a dog where you can see right down their throat. They're panting so hard, their mouth is completely wide open. You can see things down there you've never seen before. So that's the first thing I'll tend to see. Their respiration rate is going to be sky high. Often they're way up there, 80 times a minute they're breathing. Their mouth is wide open. Their tongue is hanging off to the side. If we run into heat stroke, whatever the cause, if it's in the wintertime at a dog race, we usually pack them in snow until we can bring their temperature down. If it's outside in the warmer weather, water's going to be your best thing in that I immerse the dog into some water. So, for instance, if you're outside walking your dog or running your dog and you have a stream nearby and this dog is starting to exhibit those signs, into the water they go for a short time so they can cool themselves down. It really makes a huge difference. If not, a hose, you soak the dog down. You can take ice and pack it in their armpits and their groin. That helps to bring their temperature down, too. The other thing that works good if you got it is rubbing alcohol. You just pour it on their feet, on the bottom of their feet, and that'll bring their temperature down a couple of degrees, too. So I usually soak these dogs down with a hose or in a lake. If you have ice, that's great. If you have rubbing alcohol, great. And what we want to do is bring the temperature down on those dogs, you know, 3 degrees or so. We don't want to take them down to ice level, but we want to cool them down. And how we can tell that's happening is they're usually the respiration rate and the breathing rate is going to drop because we don't have a thermometer in our pocket. So when their breathing rate usually slows down, it means that we've become or we're successful in bringing that dog's temperature down. If you can catch these dogs early, usually they don't have long-term problems with their regulation device inside to keep their thermostat correct. If they're sitting in a closing car for a long time, like you always hear about, you know, horrible stories that way, you can mess up their thermostat long term so they don't thermoregulate right and they can heat stroke much easier down the road. That tends to be the exception to the rule. So often we're encountered with these heat stroke dogs pretty quick. We react real quick and then hopefully it's a one-time occurrence.
Okay, and so then going back to the hydration too, yeah. How do I know that my dog is dehydrated?
How do you tell your dog's dehydrated? I think you have to know what normal is with dehydration and hydration to know what abnormal is. And one of the easiest things is just to see how their skin returns to its normal elasticity when you pull on it. If you take their shoulders over their shoulders, you just pull up on their skin, you can see how quickly their skin returns back to where it's supposed to be laying. If the dog is dehydrated, you'll pull up on that skin, and it'll be very slow in returning to its normal spot. And what you have to do is just practice on your own dog. Not many times, and you can tell what I mean. You've done it all without even realizing it. But if you just tug on that skin, it's called skin turgor, you can tell real quickly if the dog is hydrated or not. The other thing you can check, again with normal, so you know abnormal, is just to check to see how their gums feel above their teeth. And if you just touch it with your finger, you can tell how tacky it is or how moist it is. Again, you need to know normal so you can tell abnormal. Those are going to be probably the easiest two things to check in your own dog yard.
Dr. Tim, that was great. As far as the watering goes, you mentioned, you have hoses going to buckets to their houses. You know, I've thought about that. How do you actually do that?
How we have our kennel set up is we have 5-gallon buckets attached to the post or to the doghouse. We don't have hoses to it. We just fill them up regularly with fresh water, be it once or twice a week. So hoses into the dog circle, they're going to chew the heck out of that.
That's
not going to work. So we just haul the water to them. And then some dogs love to chew on the buckets. Again, it doesn't cause a problem, and then you have to get new buckets now and then. But I just like free excess water. It's one less step for me, and I think the dogs can then take care of their drinking needs whenever they want to. And then we can retrain them to drink on command in the fall. So that's usually been the one sticky point with some kennels. They don't want to do that because they think it might throw the dogs off with eating and drinking on the fly in racing. But those are very easily trainable things later on in the course of the season.
So you're saying some kennels also do their water on command? I guess I never heard of that. We do food on
command. You water and feed your dogs, I mean, you're just teaching them to take it when you put it down. So like in a race, you want them to drink and eat everything you put down in front of them. And part of training a dog to eat and drink is how we do that in the dog yard. So if we're watering the dogs and then feeding the dogs in the morning and in the evening like we regularly do, that's training. So we're training them to eat. It's like training your kids when dinner comes on the table, you better eat or it's gone. And the same goes with dogs. So with that in mind, some kennels or some people don't like to do free access water in the summer, just in that it might inhibit the dogs from being as trained as they as well as they could into the race season with eating and drinking. You can train a dog to eat and drink on command.
Well, thank you so much for this one, Dr. Tim.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Tim, for another great Dr. Tim's Vet Tip. And remember, if anybody wants to, they can go out to drtims.com. Fantastic dog food if you want to get something that might be a little bit different for your dog, something that's healthy, something that's rock solid, and your dogs will love it. I can't believe the change as soon as we put them on it, what they've absolutely just flipped over it.
Yeah.
We changed from a number of different brands and came over to this, and they just absolutely love it. I can tell you the difference in stools, the difference in energy, the difference in just their attention towards it has been awesome to see with the dogs. So if you guys are looking for dog food at all, that there's a lot of distributors out there, and if you need it at all, you can always go out to drtims.com and find somebody local to help you with it, but it's great stuff.
Yeah, and don't forget to use the Amazon link. We appreciate that.
If what's that all about? Well, that's simply about if you happen to be going to Amazon, you need to buy a book, you need to buy something for your dog that maybe a dog brush or something of that nature, you can go to Amazon and get it. But if you do go to Amazon, one of our Huskies just walked in. But if you do go to Amazon, if you want, go to our website first and click on the Amazon box. And what that does is it gives us credit for when you purchase anything on Amazon. We get a small little commission. You don't pay any more money. You can still use all your discounts and everything else. But at the same point, we get a little cut and it helps us pay for the website. And I don't know if you can hear that heavy breathing, but that is my little Siberian Husky sitting right next to me. So say hi, Misha.
Hi, Misha.
Hey, well, thank you so much. And we can't wait to see and hear from everybody. Again, have a great day and happy mushing.
Be blessed, everyone.